Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Archaeology has long captivated the American public, yet pop culture mythology often obscures the harsh realities, thrilling discoveries, and complex moral decisions that archaeologists confront out in the field. Journalist and conservation archaeologist Ari Barillo, in his new book American Archaeology, illuminates the joys and contradictions of digging into humanity's past, the history of the practice, its evolution into science, the influences of nationalism, colonialism, and its ongoing problems with exploitation and misrepresentation. Ari Barillo is a researcher, author, conservationist, and cultural preservationist. He holds a Master of Science in Archaeology from University of Utah and is a research associate with Archaeology Southwest. He's author of Behind the Bear's Ears, Exploring the Cultural and Natural Histories of a Sacred Landscape, and The Backwoods of Everywhere, Words from a Wandering Local. He lives in Tucson, Arizona. Ari Barillo, welcome back to the program. Thanks.
Thank you, too. It's good to be back.
We talked, at least on Backwoods of Everywhere, and enjoyable conversation. Happy to have you back on the program. So what's your goal, overall goal with this book?
The overall goal with this book primarily is to address the gap that has existed and frankly widened in recent years, especially as we've moved into the, you know, what was supposed to be the space age and is instead the age of communication. The resulting, frankly, misinformation that spins around and forms a lot of the public impression of what we do based on a long history of, frankly, fun, but not exactly accurate or respectful literature about, you know, exploration and treasure hunting and all this other, you know, bombastic spectacle nonsense that characterizes archaeology in the public eye. And just really the damage that causes, you know, the history of the practice itself is it's long, it's complicated, it's certainly got its warts and all, but it's an important endeavor. And I think it's more important now than ever that we realize that we need tools like that to preserve history from the forces that would seek to change it or wipe it out.
You say several times in the book, history is a living thing. Therefore, it's fragile. It can be damaged.
Yes, it can. And that phrase, history is a living thing, it's one that gets repeated often, especially among indigenous scholars and authors and so on here in North America. But really, it's a concept that extends around the world. I first encountered it a talk by a fellow named C.L.R. James, who was a Senegalese politician speaking in the 1950s about emerging African democracies. And you'll find it in almost those exact words all over the place. History, people think of history as a static thing. It's the stuff that happened in the past. And not exactly. The past is the past. History is a narrative that we construct based on the past, based on our understanding of it, and it changes and it evolves through time. As new information comes in and as new thoughts emerge and as, you know, additions and subtractions are made to that narrative, it really is alive. And so it also is susceptible to being silenced or damaged or even killed.
You, at the very beginning of your introduction, you tell a kind of a funny story. You're at an event, your companion is trying to figure you out. You're just a white dude with no obvious flaws or quirks, you say, kind of outdoorsy. They can see, and yet they're puzzled. You weren't going around giving talks and raising awareness about saving wilderness. Instead, you're going around giving talks and raising awareness about indigenous peoples. And you say you were frankly surprised how surprising that was. Tell me about that.
Yeah, this would be a mestiza activist friend and colleague of mine in northern Arizona. This was 2018, I believe, so very nearly 10 years ago. you know, I had just wrapped up giving a series of public talks and appearances leading up to the Bears Ears book being released. And I was speaking at all these events where a lot of people show up and they show films and they show slides about the importance of protecting America's fragile and irreplaceable wilderness, which is indeed an issue, but, you know, hardly ever mentioned in a lot of that sort of mainstream public facing literature and advocacy about conservation and wilderness preservation, at least until recent years. This has changed dramatically. But traditionally, it's all about this, you know, leave it as it is, as Theodore Roosevelt said, the hand of man can only mar it. And well, the hand of man's been at work on America's wilderness for at least 10,000, probably closer to 20,000 years. And a lot of that really hasn't made quite the splash that the wilderness in the sense of wilderness conservation model has. And those of us who've worked in archaeology, anthropology, you know, cultural preservation, any of those adjacent sort of realms, are very much aware, as Mark J. Plotkin, the ethnobotanist and founder of the Amazon Conservation Team, likes to say, where you have wilderness, you find Indians. Where you don't find Indians, you don't find wilderness. Of course, he's using an archaic term there, but he's right. I mean, these folks have been the residents, the stewards of the environment for much, much longer than, you know, people that look and talk like me. Certainly, they've helped to shape that environment, and the environment helped to shape them and their culture in return. It's a transactional relationship. And regarding one, absent the other, you're only getting part of the story. And so when I sat down with my friend, who was frankly puzzled to see, like, well, you're the kind of person who spends his weekends out there hiking. You throw on a backpack and a nice Patagonia jacket. And, you know, sorry to be offensive, but people like you typically are out there saying, yes, we need to save my favorite playgrounds. And we don't often hear from you that we need to save the, or at least help the cultures and histories that are attached to it. And to me, it seems de rigueur. And I realized then and there that that's not well known, that the at least a lot of elements in the public just aren't aware of that relationship and how important it is. And so it set me on this path to the extent that I'm capable getting that word out there.
There is something of a debate, concerns at least. You're a white guy speaking on indigenous concerns. And some people say, well, we ought to, it's maybe white people ought to just leave that to indigenous people to speak for themselves. What do you say?
I think it's a tricky and narrow needle to thread, because on the one hand, it's absolutely true, and it's worth emphasizing that nobody should speak for someone else, at least without permission or without being asked to. Unless you have literal power of attorney, you really can't speak for anyone else, and you're in doing so, you are in effect appropriating their voice. That said, when you're talking about issues that they raise, when you're talking about the problems that they face, and you have that, to circle back, that sort of white American man privilege that a lot of these folks don't have. Privilege is access. Privilege means that it doesn't mean your life is easy. It's not a golden ticket, but it means among the challenges and the obstacles that you face in your life, something like, say, racism is not one of them. Sexism is not one of them. Homophobia is not one of them. So you are at least less encumbered by those things. And so if you have a wider access, it is incumbent on you to try to find ways to use that to at least elevate voices that are encumbered in such a way. And so it boils down to do it respectfully. Make sure you have permission and don't speak for people. I do. Frankly, I get really tired, especially as an archaeologist, of people who come to me and say, well, how do the tribes feel about this? How do the tribes feel about that? How do, you know, and my answer almost invariably is, hey, hi, thanks for asking. Direct that question at them. You know, my role as essentially a preservationist and historical journalist is to amplify what they're saying, get it out there even further, use that those elements of, you know, privilege, for example, or a platform or a wider audience to expand and help to amplify their voice, but not to speak on their behalf. And so I think it is important that we bear that in mind, that no one really has the right to speak for someone else, but they can act as an amplifier.
You talked just a couple minutes ago about the side of wilderness, and you're pushing back on this a little bit. So I would move on from this, except there's some funny things in this book, and I want you to tell this hilarious story. A rancher talking to fourth graders. I'm laughing already. And he says it's important to have cows because, you know, that's where burgers come from. And the one kid keeps yelling, "Don't kill the cows." It So tell me how that thing ended up.
Oh man. Yeah. I'll try not to retread the exact wording in the book, so that listeners can get a little something more out of it. It was a public event hosted by, a friends group, an advocacy group that, you know, works alongside federal agencies in Arizona. You know, a kind of a once a year, sort of like Stewardship Day in Nine Mile Canyon up there in Utah, where the agencies and the partners get together and invite the public, and they teach them about things like history, archaeology, ranching, ecology, etc. And it was one of those. And among the speakers, you know, I was there talking about material history, and sitting next to me is the biologist, and she's talking about birds. And then the ranchers, you know, the grazing leaseholders are there, and they're explaining their side of things, or their element of things, I should say. It's not a side, to these children. And so, you know, you see these cows all over the place. They're part of the American heritage, too. And they're, you know, they've been on the land longer than me and my grandpappy and so on. And, you know, the kids are kind of listening, like nodding. Yeah, I guess it is. You know, it's a legacy practice and so on. And then he says, you know, besides, it's important. It's important to have these. And because he's trying to appeal to these kids on their level. And he says, do you like cheeseburgers? Do you like hamburgers? You know, if you didn't have cows on public lands that, you know, and side note, most of our beef comes from places like Argentina. So, but never mind all that. And this one kid in the back kind of makes this face and goes, you have to kill the cows. You have to kill the cows to do that. You can't, you have to murder the cows. Don't kill the cows. And he just starts basically chanting, don't kill the animals. This kid was, I think he was in fourth grade. And his teacher's, you know, kind of shh, you know, and silencing him. He's like, but he's talking about killing the cows, killing the animals. And it finally, you know, got the kid to be quiet. And then the end of the rancher, you know, wrapped up his little spiel and then started handing out salted beef sticks, essentially beef jerky, as a prize to all the little kiddies for sitting there and listening to his lecture. And, you know, every kid got one. And there was only one kid in the whole crowd that asked for a second helping. And it was that same kid. It was the one who was screaming, don't kill the animals, don't kill the cows. He's the only one who said, can I have another one? And I think that scene just really emphasizes the fact that there is this absolute disconnect between the world as it exists and the world as we, in a sense, consume it. Not to make a pun, but, you know, beef sticks aren't cows. Beef sticks are beef sticks. They're food. We don't make that connection. Same thing with wilderness and human history. They're separate. And we don't see how they're connected. And watching this kid, you know, get into this, frankly, admirable, youthful rage about killing the animals and then saying, hey, can I have more of that dead animal? Just absolutely cracked me up. It was the epitome of the problem.
Yeah, I just picture the kid yelling, "Don't kill the cows." He's disrupting the presentation. You write, archaeology is a popular subject in the United States. It's very popular. You say that's a bit of a problem. Why so?
Because there are really, to try to summarize as concisely as I can, there are really two ways to come at that concept of popularity. One is that something intrinsically happens to have all the right elements. It pushes all the right buttons that people get really excited about it, you know, for whatever reason. Memes oftentimes work like this. So this week, everyone's crazy about ninjas. Next week, everyone's crazy about bacon for whatever reason. And, you know, it trips the right sensors in people's brains sociologically, and it just goes wild and everyone gets really into it. That's sort of organically popular. The flip side of that is something that is made, designed to appeal to the most people that it possibly can. That's how, you know, pop music works. They closely follow the rules of music theory. You know, 1-3-5-7-5, back to the tonic, if you know music theory. Same way Hollywood operates. Same way that, you know, McDonald's or any other major food processing or manufacturing concern works. They're trying to appeal to the greatest amount of people. And in doing so, they're just following a formula. And again, they're trying to press those buttons that something organically popular presses on its own. And these two things kind of have a catalyzing effect on each other. When something becomes popular, then, you know, corporate America, quote unquote, or really anybody with a business sense, sees that happen, gets dollar signs in their eyes and jump on it and say, well, look, we can make that too, you know, and this is how trends start. And so when people get interested in something like the practice of archaeology, but the way they get interested in it is books, classic books like H. Rider Haggard's King Solomon's Mines, all the way back in the 1880s, straight through to the, you know, the men's literature pulp fiction of the early 1900s, through to the Lost World genre, through to Indiana Jones. If that's what has exposed the public to it, and that's why people have gotten so interested in it, when someone comes along and says, how do we capitalize on this? How do we make money on this? They're not going to do so by focusing on making it as accurate to the history, to the practice, to the science, to, you know, the breadth and variety of culture, to cultural sensitivity, none of that stuff that goes into the actual practice. They're going to focus on the spectacle and the bombast that got people interested in the first place, the whips and the golden idols and so forth, because that's, you know, that again presses those right buttons. So they're applying a formula. And they're amplifying all the frankly, the worst parts and making it popular in that sense. And so it's got so many people interested in archaeology. It makes it, again, very popular. But they're interested in a form of it that is wildly removed from what we actually do. People, you know, it outside of those that, quite frankly, don't know that we don't dig dinosaurs, which is an ongoing issue. But the people who do know, at least tangentially, what archaeology is, quite often they say, oh yeah, I've seen ancient aliens. Or I've watched, you know, Plundering the Past or any of that wild nonsense. And I'm glad that people have such an interest in it. But it has absolutely clouded that popularity, the way that it was engineered, in effect, has so badly clouded people's perception of how the practice actually is, how it actually works, and why it's important.
Let's take a break. We'll come back in the next segment. I'll ask you to give me some examples of actual archaeology, how it's practiced, how you practice it and others. Get into some history of archaeology and how it evolved into a science. And some current problems that we're grappling with. All that's in the book, American Archaeology. The author, R.E. Barillo, is with us. More following this break.
If you love discovering new music, Utah Public Radio invites you to tune in to the Corner Concert Series. This month, we're bringing you all of April's Corner Concerts together in 1 hour. Hear from Luke Weston, The Narcs, and Kin. Catch the Corner Concert Series 1 hour special this Friday at 10 a.m. and this Saturday at 3 p.m. only on Utah Public Radio.
Hi, this is Nick Forster. This week in E-Town, we're featuring part two of our special 35th anniversary deep dive into the E-Town archives with music from James Taylor, Joan Baez, Buddy Guy, Brandi Carlile, and my conversations with both Jane Goodall and astronauts in space. That's all this week in E-Town.
Tune in Saturday evening at 7 here on UPR.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We are talking with author R.E. Barillo. His new book is called American Archaeology. It's out now from Torrey House Press. So R.E. Barillo, we were talking before the break. There are some upsides to the popularity of archaeology, but some downsides too. If your guiding image of archaeology is Indiana Jones, etc., you're going to have some misconceptions. So talk a little bit about what archaeologists actually do, kind of the range.
Well, the irony there is much of what archaeologists originally did as the practice initially came together and catalyzed in Western culture was very much like Indiana Jones. So it's not massively dissimilar from how the practice used to be. I would say probably right up until about the 1950s. It was characterized by, at least in the United States, primarily white, primarily wealthy, or at least, you know, backed by wealthy people and primarily men, going out, finding, getting curious about, collecting and making wild guesses about the material history that's spread all over the place. And this honestly goes all the way back to like the Enlightenment period. You know, we're talking like 16, 1700s in Europe. It started as a fad, primarily rich people, and then with a tilt toward nationalism, going out and collecting vestiges of history that people could proudly show off, you know, these are my ancestors, and look, they were making these beautiful swords or whatever it was 1,000 years ago. It was just a way of trumpeting this history that they wanted to celebrate. And in Europe, when you do that, unless you're the British Empire, you're quite often looking at the history of your own people, or at least your own region. Not true in colonial or post-colonial spaces like ours. When people went and looked at the curious, you know, material history all over the place in the Americas, what they were looking at is the vestiges from the history of somebody rather unlike them, non-Eurasian, non-Western, non-white. And the way that developed then in America, quite distinctly from how it developed in Europe, this chasm formed over time, where in Europe, it's mostly people examining and eventually using science to try to recreate or reconstruct history using the clues in the material record, kind of the way that detectives use clues to reconstruct a scene, you know, what happened here. Whereas in the United States, you know, we do that to a point, but it's more about reconstructing behavior and examining the record as if you were looking almost at another species. And in fact, when race theory came along and adjacent quote unquote sciences came along, a lot of that got adapted or adopted into American archaeology. And it became this, I hesitate to call it a science, but a discipline that uses science to study indigenous peoples and their habits and their history the way that you would study, you know, lizards or birds or just something that's at a remove from the people doing the studying. And that includes, obviously, a lot of very unfortunate, very problematic elements. Thankfully, and that story's been told. That story's been told often. And one of the things I wanted to try to address with this book is when people in the mainstream American audience, shall we say, are learning about archaeology, when they're not learning about it from Ancient Aliens or Graham Hancock or any of those grifters, they're often learning about how ugly it is and how it's racist and colonialistic. And that is very true. That's how it started. But it has changed and evolved so much. Starting in, like I said, in the 1950s, it really started to skew less toward in purely investigation, less toward, you know, purely quote unquote objective study of these different peoples and their races toward preservation. Some of the biggest preservation projects, like the Glen Canyon Project, when they were flooding Lake Powell, thousands and thousands of archaeological sites were investigated, a lot of materials preserved, housed, curated in museums. Many of those, especially mortuary or items of cultural patrimony, when NAGPRA, that's the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, was passed in the 1990s, those items were and continue to this day to be pulled out of curation and returned to the tribes so that they can either curate them or rebury them. It hasn't stopped. It's the field itself has continued to evolve. It's become a lot more diverse. As I said, it started out mostly white, mostly men, much like the conservation movement, you know, with Teddy Roosevelt and his buddies. And at this point, statistically, it is a very much a woman-dominated field. A lot of people don't know that either. Every boss I've ever had and both of my academic advisors were women. So it has changed radically in that sense. In Northern Arizona, especially, as well as Southern Arizona, a lot of archaeologists are themselves indigenous people. I work with several of them. And so at one point it was Indiana Jones. At one point it was just collecting and curating. And then it was studying. And then it was reconstructing behavior as if, again, you're looking at another species. But it didn't stop there. And it has continued to evolve until, you know, nowadays it's mostly, especially in the field, a practice of cultural preservation. And we have become more protectors than investigators or analysts, at least for the most part. It's the overwhelming majority of archaeology done in North America today is what we call CRM or cultural resource management. I believe somewhere between, depending on the source, as little as 75 to up to as high as 90% of all archaeology done in the country is that it's preservation. It's, you know, pushing or at least informing compliance with Section 106 of the National Historic Preservation Act. So it's protection of history, not its exploitation, not its digging up and curating. And yes, that does still happen. And yes, it's still a problem, but it is a smaller and smaller and smaller part of what we do. And so that's the full sweep. And that's what I want people to see. That it's not Indiana Jones anymore, that it certainly isn't Ancient Aliens, and that the story does have its warts and all, so to speak. But it's an evolving story. It has its own living history. And as we move forward, it is much more concerned with sensitivity, much more concerned with preservation. And a lot of the people doing it are themselves members of the communities or descendants of the people whose material history is under scrutiny, more like how it is in Europe.
One of the challenges of today, this is sort of ripped from the headlines, at least from last year, these CRM company resource management companies that do a lot of this work, a lot of that funding is drying up.
Yes, and that is unfortunately probably the other biggest impetus behind writing this book Because the funding that's going toward what is at this point the primary form or version of archaeology as it's practiced, which again is preservation or at least mitigation of damages. That funding from at least from governments and certainly the federal government, it just gets cut and cut and cut and cut every year. And then it'll get a bit of a resurgence, you know, under Biden and Secretary Deb Haaland. Actually, curiously enough, one of the biggest influxes of funding for the management of heritage resources in North America came under George W. Bush, his version of Making America Great Again. And it's you can't celebrate much about the guy, in my opinion, but that's one that you can. But in the current, you know, in the current atmosphere, it's just cut, cut, cut. Nobody cares about history. Let's, you know, we got to fund, oh, I don't know, bombs, rockets, data centers. And so it's more and more, it's almost like an austerity measure. It reminds me of what Margaret Thatcher tried to do with the, and to a large extent succeeded doing in the National Health Service in England, where, you know, make it less of a priority for the government to look after this stuff using tax dollars and make it put more of the onus on the private sector. And that continues. And I will say, in defense of a lot of these big companies, developers, certainly not all of them, far from all of them, but a lot of them really do care about this stuff. And even beyond just making sure they don't get sued, they will pay for an archaeological inventory to be done, and they will pay for, you know, data recovery and you know, curation and all that sort of stuff. And thankfully, because as that funding continues to dry up and dry up and dry up, or be cut more accurately, from that centralized source, it becomes a kind of a scary situation where, you know, it's very difficult to roll back or entirely get rid of a law once it's been enshrined, once it's like settled law. And the National Historic Protection Act is settled law, except if there's no one there to enforce it and there's no funding to make the compliance with that law actually happen, then is it really settled law? Because at that point, that's when you start getting these questions start popping up, where, you know, politicians, legislatures start saying, well, if the agencies, the land management agencies, aren't able to enforce this because they don't have the funding, because we cut their funding, then maybe we should remove this barrier to development altogether. Because otherwise, they're going to be waiting for 2, 3, 4, 5 years for this tiny, slim number of federal employees to go out there and actually do the work. Maybe that's our reason to get rid of it. And that longer term goal is very scary, because you can't rely, as much as I'm happy and I celebrate the number of private sector developers and corporations that do pay for this stuff and do care about it, you can't rely on them for that. You can rely on settled law, at least as long as they are funding the ability to comply with it. And as that funding goes away, it makes that law look shakier and shakier and shakier. And if the law goes away, then it's a free-for-all.
We're talking with Ari Barillo. The book is American Archaeology. Let's take another break. When I come back, I want to talk about some current issues, very current issues, that illustrates current practice of archaeology, the usefulness, right, the value of it, but also some ethical concerns. We'll have more following this break.
Next time on LA Theater Works, the legendary rise and fall of an American energy giant.
Today, I'm pleased to announce the appointment of Jeffrey Skillen to the post of president of the Enron Corporation.
Enron by Lucy Prebble, next time on LA Theater Works.
Tune in Friday night at 9 here on UPR.
I'm Julie Rose, host of the Top of Mind podcast. Was America founded by divine intervention or profit-seeking slaveholders or noble men in pursuit of freedom?
Having a coherent story is really essential. But in our case, it's a particularly complicated undertaking and always has been.
The angst over America's founding story and why it matters is Top of Mind.
Tune in Sunday morning at 9 here on UPR.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking about archaeology. We're talking about the book American Archaeology, Living History, Stolen Past and Defending the Future. The author is Ari Barillo, and he is a researcher, author, conservationist, cultural preservationist. He's a research associate with Archaeology Southwest. He's out with this very interesting book from Torrey House Press. Ari Barillo, I want to skip to your fascinating chapter on the future of archaeology, and I want to have you talk a bit about this. We've all heard of this, the Kamloops Indian Residential School in British Columbia, and one of these boarding schools, right? Atrocities happen in many of these schools. This was a very, I guess a pun here, groundbreaking case. But I wonder if you'd tell us about this case as it regards archaeology, some of the issues that confront archaeologists, the value, right, of what this archaeological team did, but also some of the ethical concerns they're running into.
Yeah, Kamloops, as far as I know, Kamloops was the case that burst the dam, because the idea that, I don't know the numbers, but I'm going to say at least tens of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of Native Americans in the United States, as well as First Nations, so their term for it in Canada, children were yanked away and forced to go to these boarding schools to, in effect, have the indigenousness beaten out of them so that they could more easily acculturate into mainstream culture. And it's the practice that, boy, it's hard to put a date on when it ended, because some of those schools are technically still open. But this notion that there were atrocities committed there, and in some cases, not even atrocities, just things like, you know, tuberculosis got around and a bunch of kids died, and, you know, whatever the case is, but certainly a lot of abuse, and even in some cases, abuse leading unto death. And this has been known, because those kids, you know, they're human, they graduate, they tell their stories. And, but it was really not known to mainstream sensibilities until the Kamloops case. And suddenly it became this growing interest, a very fervent interest in looking into more and more and more of these boarding schools. It was already an atrocity to yank children away from their parents and force them to this school where they weren't allowed to practice their traditional practices, speak their traditional language. I mean, that in itself is an atrocity. But then it also turns out a lot of them were dying. Some of them were dying under mysterious and in some cases overtly violent circumstances, being buried in the backyard, so to speak. Boy, that warrants looking into. And as it expanded out from there to other schools in Canada and then eventually here in the United States, you know, we're finding evidence, air quotes around that word evidence, but evidence of hundreds of what we would call, you know, unmarked graves, even mass graves at some of these boarding schools. And what do you do about that? Because as it stands, if indeed you have this, you know, a structure on a compound and there's unmarked graves all over the place, you can dig the whole place up. If you do that, you're disturbing not only the environment, you're going to be disturbing those, assuming they're there, those children, essentially, those, you know, remains. That's disrespectful. No one likes to have a shovel put through them. And so it creates this quandary. And that's part of the controversy is, okay, if they're there, what do we do about it? Because you can't, it was disrespectful to inter them that way to begin with. It's also pretty disrespectful to yank people out of the ground. And so archaeology offers at least a potential solution because, as I said, the practice has evolved, as hard as it can, has evolved away from smash and grab treasure seeking, away from destructive analysis, and toward not only toward preservation, but toward methods that do as little destruction as possible. And one of them is ground penetrating radar. If you can see underground without having to dig, then you're getting the exact same information that you would get by digging, but you're not destroying anything in the process. And GPR is, I would argue, it's still in its infancy, but it has come a long way in the last few decades. But that's one of the things that they're using to be able to look underground and to essentially to give credence to these stories, to give history and agency to these individuals, while at the same time not disturbing them further. And that, I think, is a real milestone in the practice of archaeology, as well as its importance and its utility outside of the purely academic, outside of the purely administrative or managerial. Here is a way that we can use this practice and the tools that it has to address this part of history and to really give it weight. And again, to give history or give agency to these individuals without having to put a shovel through them.
You mentioned in this chapter four myths of archaeology. I'll just read these, and I want you to talk about the first one, which you go on in greater length in the book. Archaeology is a neutral and objective exercise. You say that's a myth. The humans are selfish, competitive, and power-hungry, a myth. The current societal order was and is inevitable, the third myth. And fourth is things will inevitably be better or worse in the future. What if you talk about that first one? Archaeology is a neutral and objective exercise. You're emphasizing in the book that's you believe that's a myth.
Yes, those are the four points that were identified by a group of archaeological radicals calling themselves the Black Trowel Collective. They're headed up by Dr. Lewis Bork. And they're a fantastic team. I love them. But they identified those as the four of the biggest myths that even outside of mainstream understanding, within the discipline itself, we still have to grapple with because they're very much there and they're very much myths. And that first one is especially tricky because you can't really do investigation of humans as a human while being 100% objective in any sense. It's a virtual, if not literal, impossibility. Even the choice to investigate human history is a choice. You could be choosing to do anything else. So right out of the gate, it's not objective. It's you know, you're doing it and you have a reason and you have a purpose, whether it's because you want to return to my example a moment ago, you want to give agency or voice to people, whether indigenous or even, you know, Africans in North America, thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of enslaved Africans were brought over. And in the history books, quite often, it's just, you know, Columbus arrived and then there were slaves and then Abraham Lincoln freed them all and then history begins. And like that little footnote accounts for, again, potentially millions of individuals with different histories and languages and practices. And this is a way to say, hang on, they were people, and give them a voice, give them a place, an agency in the past. If you choose to do that, you have your reasons for doing that. And it's the sort of reasons that I am very much on board with, but don't pretend it's objective. You can't pretend it's objective. We do this stuff for a reason, and they are very human reasons. Physics can be objective. Chemistry can be objective. A humanistic science or a humanistic practice using science like archaeology absolutely cannot be. And it reminds me of what Hunter S. Thompson in particular brought to journalism with his so-called gonzo journalism. And this is also, I mentioned already, Mark Plotkin, what he and his colleagues brought to anthropology, and his mentor, Richard Evans Schultes, brought to anthropology, which is, stop trying to be objective. You're going to be part of the story anyway. Just lean into it. Tell a human story. Be humanistic in your investigation and your reporting. Stop pretending that you're a robot, being neutral and being objective, because it just doesn't work. It comes across as disingenuous, and it can at sometimes even prop up the wrong ideas. It was total, an insistence on total journalistic objectivity that helped, to a certain extent, help the Nazis come to power in Germany, because people were saying, and this was long before Hunter S. Thompson, but people were saying, you know, as journalists, we have to keep our distance and you know, not impinge on our neutrality or objectivity. So we're going to show both sides, even though one of them is obviously evil. We're not allowed to say that because we're objective. No, I'm sorry, but no, what you're doing is a human practice, looking at human lives and human history and human culture and just human things. Be human about it. Because otherwise you're being, again, you're being disingenuous, and in some cases, you know, just propping up the wrong ideas. And so be gonzo scientists, I think.
Well, we've reached the end of our time. I just want to mention just a few of the things in Appendix B, Visiting with Respect. Pick up the book and take a look at these. GPS reveals too much. Don't give out GPS points. Leave culture belongings where they are. Leave fossils where they are. Stay on established trails. Dogs and archaeology don't mix. Guide children through the sites. Historic artifacts aren't trash. And many others here. That's Appendix B, helping you to visit some of these sites. Ari Barillo, American Archaeology, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure. Hope to catch up again in the future.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. And thanks, everybody, for listening to Access Utah.
Scoutcher Leo T here, where it's one sky, many cultures. As we enjoy this strange yet beautiful spring after listening to the birds and getting up in the hills and trees during the day if you can, and starting at dusk, the magical April skies show us a magical array, and the orbs brighten as Venus brightens and rises high in the southwest. The sky darkens after a while, and the big orbs pop out above and toward the west. Yellowish Pollux and white Castor, which mark the heads of Gemini, positioned above Jupiter, and if you were paying attention to the half moon, which was just below Jupiter on the 22nd, almost making a circle. And if you look at Jupiter with a small telescope, you can see Jupiter's Galilean moons doing their little moon dance around the big planet. For instance, a couple of days ago, on the 22nd, you would see three or four satellites. Closest to Jupiter at the time was Io, while flanking the big planet, right there. At greater distance, at about 8:39 p.m., it disappears behind Jupiter. Then a couple of hours later, Europa will emerge from behind it, having been hidden by Jupiter's shadow. Every night's a little different. If, like me, when I can calm down enough and get off my rear end, take the time with my little burgundy telescope, it's a pretty good thing to do, fun and engaging to know you're looking at these little planets moving around a giant planet almost a billion miles away. And way outside the solar system, Earth's first cosmic Voyager, Voyager 1, traveling through the solar system and out beyond the influence of the sun's heliosphere, launched in April of 1977 and still communicating with Earth with a very small transmitter, JPL. The magicians out there and NASA have just shut down a science instrument on the probe to extend the life of the spacecraft, the low-energy charged particles instrument it's called. Voyager 1 will be able to conserve energy without the spacecraft getting so cold that its fuel lines freeze. Go, Voyager, go, with your gold record of the rhythm blues and the sounds of music and animals from all over the world. Could Mars ever have lightning? An article from a magazine called Echo says, even in its thin air? Well, I do believe there is, as 55 strikes noted by NASA's Perseverance rover during whirlwinds and storm fronts show so. And just a few days ago, a southwestern Utah-style dust devil wheeled its magical way across the landscape, firing off a bolt. If I can find the photo, I'll put it on the Skywatcher Leo T Facebook page along with tantalizing photos from all of this episode. And don't forget, if you would like to support Skywatcher Leo T with an underwriting message, you can do so by contacting me at leotskywatcher@gmail.com. Two meteor showers are crossing over. The Lyrid meteor shower, which started April 16th, just peaked on April 22nd, while the Eta Aquarid meteor shower began on April 19th and will peak overnight on May 5th and 6th. It's one sky, many cultures. With Skywatcher Leo T, let's take the little Skywatcher spaceship around the globe to Western Australia, where customs and traditions combine to tell stories of the night. Oh, hey, but first, let's stop off in northeastern United States, where a storytelling session at a forbidden ceremony, one of the children related a tale told by grandmother about a special place called Skyworld. It was the original home of the ancestors of the Long House people, and if the Iroquois children went there, they would be welcome home. The first people's ancestors. One night, while seven children were dancing and singing around the fire, they asked Heaven Holder to take them up to the Sky World. He did a special dance and sang a special song. Just as they began to feel themselves being lifted into the sky, a group of parents who had followed their trails into the woods showed up. They were upset that the children had disobeyed them, and their anger turned to despair as the children rose into the sky. And as they did, they realized how badly they had felt about harming their own flesh and blood. Higher and higher, the seven children rose. One of them turned to look downward as he began to fall. He plummeted faster and faster until he became a luminous streak. The other dancers permanently disappeared into the heavens. After this, when parents witnessed a shooting star, they would vow never to strike their children again. And when the people of the Longhouse go outside now, at the time of the harvest, they look to the northeast for the Seven Sisters or the Pleiades, the little cluster of stars in the Sky World, and tell their children how much they love them. So love your children, look up, look around, and get lost in space. Skywatcher Leo T.